184 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Wall Street may be likened to that gloomy ravine which led down to the depths of Dante's Inferno. Here souls lost in the maze of their own greeds and passions wander in the dim light that finds its way down between the towering skyscrapers that rise cliff-like on either hand. Wall Street is a most appropriate symbol of the path of glory which General Wolfe declared leads but to the grave, for at one end of that short but awful thoroughfare lay the murky and polluted waters of the river, at the other stand the crumbling and moss-covered headstones of Trinity's churchyard. There is a common saying upon the street that those who succeed are laid away in pomp to the chime of old Trinity's bells, while those who fail are found floating upon the turbid breast of the river. As one gazes downward upon the teeming world maelstrom of human endeavor where millions of creatures in ant-like confusion struggle to survive, with no time, no strength, no opportunity to dream, to hope, or to aspire, he can better sense the incubus of civilization. To what end all this cyclopean struggle, in which destruction is ever the victor? As one regards this seething cauldron where, like the witches of Macbeth, the three sisters Ignorance, Superstition, and Fear brew their poisonous broths, he cannot but recall the prophetic words of Prospero. In the tempest, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yeah, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind, we are such stuff as dream are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. When the Bishop of Ripon suggested to the British Association for the Advancement of Science that it take a 10-year vacation for the good of the human soul, this venerable church man precipitated a storm of protest. The very greatness of his man's recent achievements, declared the bishop, would seem to make his ruin more certain and more complete. While any cessation of man's effort to improve his own status would undoubtedly prove disastrous, there is no doubt that the bishop has sensed an impending catastrophe, that ever-widening gap between the spiritual and the material life of man. Man's internal progress has failed to keep abreast with the growth of his conveniences. With the advent of the washing machine, it cannot be said that we have registered corresponding improvement in our standards of beauty, ethics, and aesthetics. The popular superstition that if the body is comfortable, the spirit will take care of itself has not been justified by experience. Although too many churchmen wander in a maze of theological complexities, still for the most part they recognize the need of spiritual education. If his inner nature fails, man perishes, and while in the last analysis failure can only be temporary, still to disregard the sciences of the higher life is but to prolong the agonies of the unillumined state. The enlightened theologian does not desire to tear down the achievements of science or belittle the blessings that it has conferred upon mankind. The true spiritual thinker merely affirms the necessity of elevating the sciences of the soul to a parity with those of the body. He regrets that man should learn to live so well only to ultimately die as badly as before. Whereas, according to the theologian, man may live in this world but a few score years, he is predestined to endure in a transcendental state throughout all eternity. If he is willing to spend so great a part of his life equipping himself for the little span of earth life, should he not, argues the bishop, also give some consideration to that greater life of which the present is but the vestibule? A just criticism against modern science is that as it magnifies by its repeated emphasis the importance of terrestrial concerns, it belittles in like measure the still nobler concerns of the spirit. Savants are too prone to solve the problem of the after-death state by disdainfully rejecting the concept of immortality as but another survival of primitive superstition. Thus, the day of greatest physical light bids fair to become the day of greatest spiritual darkness. It is questionable if science will. Tihi Mission op Aesthetics 185. 186 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Ever be able to make the earth such a desirable locale that world-worn souls will not ultimately be glad to escape from its stifling environment. The goal of science apparently is perpetuation of the physical ical life, which seemingly is the only life of which it is sure. Since woman is devoting more of her time to consideration of world problems, she may be gratified to learn that one science tist assures us that within the next century babies will be manufactured in the laboratory to meet any and all specifications. Physical immortality, therefore, may be regarded as the ultimate goal of science, which can conceive of no other form of immortality. Thus, the modern scientist actually seeks that same elixir of life which he ridicules the medieval alchemist for declaring to be a reality. The church very properly opposes this so-called practical attitude, since if physical immortality be the real goal of existence, the universe is without integrity, for how can the dead past share in the immortality of the unborn future? The mystic also realizes the insufficiency of this new physical urge which worships a word and pays homage to its own achievements as summed up in the term practical. To him the word is a sin, a name for the prosaic in whose presence the finer qualities of life must inevitably languish and die. No sane man would block the progress of human thought or condemn any real contribution to the life, happiness, or efficiency of the race. Men and women with vision would, however, rejoice if they could see growing up in the world an institution both vast and beautiful which would serve the aesthetic needs of the individual, and would ensure that life would be not only efficient, but also beautiful, that man would enjoy not only health of body but be possessed of healthy emotions and ideals. The population of Earth is sufficient to assure science that it will never be without a body of informed men and women to carry forward its ideals. There are enough also to form another group as strong, as noble, and as true to preserve those aesthetic principles which existed long before the dawn of modern thought and without which science as an institution could never have existed. Tihi Mission of Aesthetics 187. When by some joyous exception of nature we find the scientist in whom the beautiful is an awakened and radiant force, there results a type of mind as constructive as any modern society can produce. It will yet be demonstrated that no scientist can achieve to the highest in his chosen field until he acknowledges the existence of a superphysical nature which survives the dissolution of its temporal parts. Even as men in primitive times fashioned crude images and then bowed humbly before their own creations, so the scientist of today has but elevated his superstitions to a more dignified level, for having fashioned with his own reason the entire body of science, he now contemplates with an awe approaching blind adoration the craftsmanship he has wrought. Without doubt, the prosaic attitudes of scientific men have done much to turn thinking minds from the contemplation of aesthetics to the more utilitarian themes of biology and physics. Science has the unquestioned advantage of tangible evidence of its utilitarian value. We are ever surrounded by the examples of scientific accomplishment, while the accomplishments of aesthetics, being largely limited to the internal nature, make no showing impressive to the uncultured. With its emphasis solely upon the practical, the realistic interpretation of life over-justifies existing conditions, for it assumes that because deformity exists it must be necessary and Being necessary, it must be beautiful. Dr. Wildrand has defined the true offices of realism and idealism. Existing conditions, he declared, should be analyzed in the terms of realism and reconstructed in the terms of idealism. There is an element of precocity among civilized peoples today which is most unseemly. Sophistication is everywhere. The surfeit of advantages which we have enjoyed has brought in its train the state of boredom. Nothing pleases, nothing suffices, nothing intrigues. The race has an inclination to sit around and await dissolution as the one remaining experience that may contain the clement of novelty. College youths finds it necessary to murder in order to create a passing thrill. Externally we are simply over-civilized, internally we are morons. The very people who suffer most keenly for this chronic ennui, who are satiated with the entire subject of life, have never really experienced in their thoughts, feelings, or actions any of the more profound verities of existence. Turning from the sordidness of realism, let us look at the world through the eyes of those dreamers who have dared to believe that the good in human nature would ultimately blossom forth and regenerate the entire social system. Beauty, declared the ancient philosophers, was the only offering except able to the gods. Furthermore, beauty being the environment of divinity, God himself was present in every manifestation of the beautiful. In the scriptures it is written that if the temple is built according to the law, the living God will dwell therein. The Greek Dionysiacs symbolized the establishment of world harmony by the erection of a temple to the universal creator. Upon the theory that like attracts like, they philosophized that when the world was made beautiful, souls of the nature of beauty would incarnate to people it. Because of their belief in reincarnation, the Greeks taught that rational souls incarnated in harmonious environments, whereas discordant areas were populated with irrational creatures whose own internal discord attracted them to a discordant sphere. The remarkable physical symmetry for which the Greeks are justly famed is ascribed to a peculiar practice. Perspective. Mothers were isolated from the confusion of the community life and spent their days in secluded gardens filled with statuary, representative of the ideals of grace and beauty. They were not permitted to look upon any asymmetrical object lest it mark the coming child. In some communities they went so far as to destroy at birth the crippled or unsightly. This was done not only to prevent the suffering resultant from such affliction, but also that society might not through the sight of such malformations perpetuate that which was not beautiful. Much of our crime and degeneracy can be traced to home environment. Mystical philosophy declares heredity in its conventional sense to be a fallacious doctrine. We do not actually inherit the traits of our ancestors, rather, these traits are environments which call into incarnation souls of a like degree